Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. And today we're looking at the history of one of Britain's favourite dishes. And if you're already smelling salt, vinegar, and maybe even tartar sauce if you're posh, you've guessed right. Let me just unpack this here, because I will be eating through this entire podcast, because I've just been down to my local chippy. Now, fish and chips is an absolute British classic and a colossal earner for the food industry. 382 million portions are sold every year. It's just the sound of my pickled egg being opened by fish and chip shops alone. And Britain has 8,600 fish and chip shops. Whether you're at the local chippy, at a pub or a high-end restaurant, it's usually on the menu in some form. Countless variations on a very simple theme. But why? Why are fish and chips so popular? Oh, there's a little bit of steam coming off my chips there. Why do Brits love them so much? And shock horror, is it even a British dish at all? Well, with me to travel back in time to when fish plus chips was just a dream in a lone genius mind is Professor Panikos Panayi. Panikos is Professor of Fish and Chips at Devonport University. Well, actually, he's not. He's Professor of European History. But his research includes the history of immigration and inter-ethnic relations and the history of food. He's also the author of the excellent book, Fish and Chips, A Takeaway History. Panikos, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I hope you've got some fish and chips in front of you as well.
Not today.
What?
Maybe later in the week.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't recommend my local chippy, actually. I'm not going to tell you where it is, but it's all right. Yeah, it's a decent chippy, but it's not refined. But then that's what people like, I guess. Well, so let's start with the big question, first of all. Why do you think fish and chips has become this emblematic British meal and more so like than other great classics like Toad in the Hole and Bangers and Mash? Why fish and chips?
Well, there's a variety of answers. I guess if you look at its history, it's sort of, I mean, there's takeaways before fish and chips, but when it takes off in the late Victorian period, in the lead up to the First World War, it's a sort of easy working class food, and it's also cheap. And then what happens in the...
I just paid £10.80 for this. It's not cheap.
Yeah,
maybe it was. Maybe it was, yes.
Yeah, it's an expensive takeaway today. I mean, I don't know, mine's about £9 is what I pay, so that does... But I mean, I think...
But back in the day...
Yeah, it would have been a cheap takeaway. So that was one of the reasons that it takes off in the first place. I mean, your other question about why is it more emblematic of Britishness than, you know, something like Toad in the Hole. I mean, by the middle of the 20th century, you know, by the 1950s, it seems to have the sort of almost the same importance, status as, you know, there's one book that I read which compared with rice for the Chinese. You know, it's just so central to the British diet in that period. You know, its peak is from the end of the 19th century to the middle, you know, to the 1960s, let's say.
Yeah.
And by the 1950s and 1960s, it's just a core part of the working class diet, really.
But keep talking, I'm still chewing on more chips.
But the other thing is it sort of constructed as British during the course of the 1960s, because what happens is you know, people almost subconsciously, well, they eat fish and chips without thinking about its ethnic origins. And then what happens in the 1960s is the National Federation of Fish Fryers in particular, but also wider media outlets, there's a sort of reaction against the arrival of the Chinese and Indian takeaway. And so then it's labelled as British, even though, you know, it may have taken off in Great Britain.
Yeah.
But you know, that's when it's, when the labelling takes place, if you like. But I mean, you know, it's a very important element of working class nutrition for, you know, 70, 80 years, well, probably until the present day, although, as you said before, it has become a bit posher.
It's posh now, isn't it? Yeah, it's dead posh.
Well, it's quite expensive, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to those origins. So I mean, I'm looking at the constituent parts here. This is potatoes. Obviously, potatoes grow very well in some climates in the UK, certainly in places like Lincolnshire and Herefordshire and places like that. But also cod, which is now an expensive piece of protein. But back in the day, cod was dirt cheap, and we used to, you know, used to just haul it out of the oceans in vast quantities. So was cod not considered a refined sort of special food? What was it, sort of dirt cheap, like the hot dog of the day?
Well, the first fish that seems to have been served when fish and chips takes off, or when fried fish takes off amongst the wider British populace, i.e. when it stops being Jewish, which I'm sure we'll come back to later on, is in the 1850s. And the fish that seems to take off in the first place, is plaice.
That's even posher. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but it probably wasn't in the 1850s. And I think it's by the early 20th century that cod and haddock start replacing place, although of course you still can get lots of fish and chip shops which do sell place, or some fish and chip shops which sell place. But I mean, I guess the essence of frying and battering fish is that it has to be a non-oily fish, and it has to be a firm fish. Otherwise, well, you know, you can't batter oily fish. I mean, well, possibly you can, but I'd hate to think what
I have tried it myself. It is an avalanche of oil. Yeah, afterwards you feel a bit stunned by the whole experience. I have to say, stunned by sheer volume of fat,
interior and exterior oil.
Yeah, exactly. But what about its popularity worldwide? I mean, I've got a mate, Patrick, who's in France, and he gave up running the local bar, and he now runs a fish and chip shop with Union Jacks on it. But is it much more popular in Britain than elsewhere in the world, or are there just different versions of it around the world?
Well, I mean, I think it is essentially a British dish, or has become a British dish. I mean, it has Jewish origins, fried battered fish. But the country where it sort of becomes very dominant from the 1850s onwards is Great Britain. The one country where it did have something of a takeoff in the 1920s was Germany. But I mean, I've lived in Germany in the last 20-30 years, and there are fish and chip shops in Germany, not very many,
mainly currywurst.
Yeah, but I mean, there's the occasional in Berlin. There's a chain which has, well, not really a chain, which has two or three shops, and the way they do it, of course, is horrific to somebody like me, because what they do is they pre-cook the fish and pre-cook the chips and then refry it, which you just never would do in Great Britain. I mean, yeah, you may pre-cook the chips, but you know, they'd hang around for a while, and you know, if you turn up, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes after they've cooked, they're not going to be very nice, but they would never refry them. Whereas in these German fish and chip shops, that's quite normal. And then the other place where fish and chips spread is, I guess, what we'd call the Anglo-Saxon world. So the USA, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. So when I was doing the research for my book, various colleagues and former colleagues sent me pictures of fish and chip shops in Canada and New Zealand and so on. So, but I mean, there they use different types of fish, but again, it has to be the hard white solid fish which can withstand the frying process,
the brutality of the deep fat fryer.
Exactly.
Okay, now before we really delve into the history, I'd like to know why fish and chips. Why, Panikos, you have gone for fish and chips? Are you a massive fish and chip fan yourself, and why are you interested in this particular dish?
Well, my parents have told me that it was the first solid food I ate, I was born in I grew up in Essex Road in North London, and basically there was a fish and chip shop opposite our house, so that's one origin of my fish and attraction to fish and chips, if you like. But I guess, you know, how I came to it as an author was I did another book called Spicing Up Britain, which is about, you know, the multicultural origins or multicultural influences on British food. And the publisher asked me if I wanted to do a follow-up book on fish and chips, because what happened is I was trying to get interviewees, and my university did a press release and revolving around fish and chips, and then some people will accuse me of being anti-patriotic by claiming that fish and chips wasn't British. But anyway, that now this idea of it having non-British origins has been more widely accepted.
Okay, well, let's dive into that then. Let's look at its origins. You mentioned it is a Jewish dish as well. What are the roots of fish and chips?
Well, the fish does have Jewish origins, so you can find recipe books going back to the 15th and 16th centuries. And then in the 18th century and the 19th century, you have cookbooks, which in English cookbooks, which talk about fried fish in the Jewish style. So, you know, some really classic cookbooks talk about that. So when I was doing my research, I actually came across references to fires involving Jewish people in the East End of London. And actually what was happening, the reason there were these fires is because their fish frying equipment had gone out of hand and caused a fire. So in
notoriously dangerous stuff.
Yeah, so in that sense, it's a very Jewish dish, you know. That's almost circumstantial evidence, if you like, which proves the case. That's not what I was looking for, but you know, that's what proved it. And then you have other books which were published in the 1850s, which talk about, you know, going into Jewish fried fish shops. And then the potato is a bit more complicated. I mean, it arrives in Europe in the 15th, 16th century, but it doesn't really take off in Britain. It's not eaten wide. Well, it's eaten in Ireland by the 18th century. In England, it's not really taking off until the Napoleonic Wars onwards, i.e., right at the beginning of the 19th century onwards. And one of the reasons for that is that because of the war and shipping difficulties, it's more importation of grain becomes more expensive, and so that's how the potato takes off.
Homegrown carbohydrate was much more important all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, it always is. I mean, it's homegrown, exactly. And when it becomes chips, again, the French fries seems to be the accepted, you know, idea that it is French in origin. And it arrives probably in Britain, the chips, from about the 1860s, 1870s. Mm. And then, you know, the really key development is the takeoff of the railways in the 1840s, because before the 1840s, you only really ate fresh sea fish if you live near the coast. By about, I don't know, 1850, 1855, most places in Britain, I don't think there's anywhere in Britain which is more than 2 hours away from the coast. So that meant that everyone can have fresh fish, which is probably why, you know, that's an important reason why it's taken off in Britain rather than anywhere else. I guess if you did the same for Germany.
Okay, because the railways were widespread in the UK, in Britain, before the rest of the world.
But I mean, it's also the coast, isn't it? You know, and the
availability.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the fish is caught and can be quickly brought to everybody, to, you know, where I'm speaking from now, somewhere like Leicester, which may be about as far away from the sea as you can get.
Absolutely.
More, you know, as anywhere else in the country.
Yeah. Okay, well, let us consider for a moment the chip. Here is a chip, quite a fat one here. And how has it evolved? I mean, these days we know a French fry as being a thinly cut chip. Obviously, the mechanics and the physics of that is interesting, because obviously a larger surface area to volume ratio means that it can absorb more fat, and therefore the fat and chucked in salt and tastes delicious. But our chips are bigger. Now, has the chip evolved in the UK? Did it used to be a little French fry, and did they genuinely come from France?
I think probably in when it was French, it probably was thinner than it was in Britain. Unfortunately, what happens is there seems to be little evidence to tell us exactly when it surfaces in Britain. So if you look at cookbooks in the 1860s and 1870s, they do seem to describe the French fry type chip.
Yeah.
So what seems to happen is that some time from about the 1870s, 1880s onwards, it becomes thicker. And if you look at early descriptions of how fried fish is served, i.e. when it stops being purely Jewish, then sometimes it's served with bread or even baked potatoes.
Shocking behavior.
Well, that's I'm what
disgusted
happened. So in the second half of the 19th century, the thick chip takes off.
And do we know why?
No, we don't. I mean, I haven't come across any evidence that tells us precisely why. I mean, it just seems to have been that there was this evolutionary process, if you like, where there was experimentation about what should go with the fried fish.
Yeah.
And by about 1900, you know, the thick chip had established itself as the natural partner of the fried fish.
I guess if you take a cynical view of it, the thick chip absorbs less fat, and therefore there's more potato. Therefore, presumably, it costs a bit less for the chip shop owner to produce it.
Yeah, quite possibly. From the point of view of cheapness as well. For the consumer.
We're talking about a product that was, you know, for the working classes, I guess that would have been really important. So let's consider the chip again from a scientific point of view and the chemistry of it. Now, oh, just dropped my chip. Oh, that's a terrible thing. So this chip, it's absorbed fat. It's browned on the outside. That's the Maillard reaction creating those savoury flavours that wouldn't have been there from just a baked chip. Unless there was oil and a really high temperature involved. Do you think that the chemistry, the sensory perception elements of the entire dish, the moistness, the crispness, and the flavour compounds in it are an essential part of its popularity as well?
Yeah, I mean, it must be in the British context, though I guess in... I mean, to add to that, I guess once you add the salt and the vinegar on, then that smell intensifies even further.
It's an whole avalanche of sensory perception.
Yeah,
going on
exactly.
There,
yeah. Except if you look at it in many ways, you can reverse that and say for many non-British people, it's the epitome of the blandness of British food. But I mean, I'm more in the former camp, you know.
You could say the same thing about Japanese food. Japanese food is very much less about taste, except for the umami flavouring. It's much more about texture. Yeah, and so many Japanese foods are a textural journey more than they are a taste journey. For instance, garlic doesn't feature hugely in much Japanese food, whereas it does in Western food. So perhaps, you know, could you allow us a little bit of expertise on textural perception, textural appreciation?
Well, I mean, it's the hard outside, which if it's cooked proper, I guess what's absolutely crucial about taste and fish and chips is that you really have to eat it straight out of the pan, don't
yeah.
you? Because the way I tend to eat it is I wrap it and then bring it home, which, okay, it's fine, but it's not the same as, you know, taking it straight out of the pan
yeah.
and eating it. I mean, you know, the ultimate...
Because that crispness, it sort of steams in the pan,
exactly,
isn't it?
Which exactly.
is, mine's already started doing that
yeah,
right
exactly. And it's, so, I mean, for me, it's almost more satisfactory if I eat it, you know, in one of those cones
absolutely.
Rather than almost on a plate. I'm sure that does something.
Cone rarely seen now except in the posher places, which is bizarre, usually printed with newspaper print that didn't actually exist on the
well
cone.
The other day I went to a fish and chip shop in North Sea in central London, and I demanded a cone rather than one of those plastic trays, and you know, that was That was really satisfying eating it in that way.
Absolutely. Gosh, you must be the most terrifying customer in a fish and chip shop.
Well, I never tell them who I am. So,
do you know who I? Do you know, I'm a professor of fish and chip. Okay, so but let's go back to this idea. Now, you're a professor of European history. You've looked at immigration and inter-ethnic relations. Do you have any issue with the concept of a national dish? Is it a flawed idea that fish and chips is ours, that Bœuf bourguignon belongs to the French, you know, that there are boundaries to be drawn with these things?
Well, I mean, obviously, a minute ago you talked to me about Japanese food. If you go to Japan, they obviously don't eat the same food as we, so yeah. As we do in Britain. So, you know, clearly there are different parts of the world, different parts of Europe, maybe in some European countries different. I mean, my parents originate from Cyprus, and you know, different people in different parts of the country cook their foods differently.
Yeah. But what was your national dish then? What was your parents' national dish?
Well, we used to eat that. They used to eat a lot of pulses, which is, you know, they grew up in a peasant environment, so that's what provided the protein, basically. So I'm not sure there was any national dish essentially, but I guess I wouldn't say national dishes have been politicized necessarily, but there is this idea that you need to have a national dish in the same way you need to have a national flag or a national, you know, anthem or whatever.
Yeah, these things can be useful to bind people together, but they can sort of also reflect otherness and concepts that aren't necessarily that positive.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, fish and chips wouldn't be a particularly political concept, but I mean, somebody
tell the Icelandic people.
Yeah, okay, that's a different issue.
That is a different issue. That's economics.
From a national identity point of view, I mean, it's a fairly tame manifestation, if you like, of nationalism, identity.
So we can think it's a good thing.
Well, it's better than, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of work on World War I and World War II. Mm. It's better to have identities through your food rather than, you know, fall out in full-blown war.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's almost it's almost a successor to what happened in the... You can't eliminate national identity or national ideas. So, you know, it's quite... You know, it's not harmful, really.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get back to the nuts and bolts of fish and chips then. So when and where, do we know when and where the first fish and chip shop started?
Well, the first fish and chip shop developed in the East End of London in the 1850s, 1860s, but there is a counterclaim the first one was in the north of England, but I mean, I think I'm very convinced about the East End origins because of the research I've done and the Jewishness. Mm. A lot of the northern claims revolve more around the chip rather than the fish.
Yeah.
So you know, I think it is. I mean, I'm quite happy that it's an East End or of East End origin.
Yeah. And would you say that the dish that I have in front of me, which is a pretty standard sort of basic version of fish and chips, it has the same characteristics as those early fish and chip shops served?
I think the fish does. Yeah.
Yeah. The same sort of batter technique.
Yeah. The fish. I guess it's fish. Chips and then salt and vinegar. So I think salt and vinegar come along quite early, by about 1900. You know, salt and vinegar are quite standard. I mean, the thing you fry, the frying medium, i.e., the oil, changes over time. So one of the things that was used quite early, and I'm not sure I've never seen this sold, is cottonseed oil.
Oh wow!
And I'm not even sure how that would taste.
Yeah.
Or if it will be legal today. I mean, I don't know
that
if it's as
fat.
Bad.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's as bad as. I mean, I'm sure it's fine. I don't. But that's we can never buy that anymore.
Yeah.
That was the early medium. So I guess for much of the 20th century, it's lard, isn't it? Which has gone out of fashion now.
And if you taste bloody good though.
It tastes different. I mean, I had a day out at the headquarters of the National Federation of Fish Fries during my
Of
research,
course you did.
and coincidentally, they had a training day, so I had fish and chips fried in lard, and that does it's quite it's a very different taste from. I mean, I think in the South, they tend to use vegetable oil,
Yeah.
and so it's a
Can
you
you
know.
describe the lard fried chip for me? Are there words in your lexicon for this?
I think, unfortunately, when I was there, one of the friars told me that it sits on your stomach afterwards, and that's
That was the
what.
abiding memory you came away with,
Yeah,
not the
and if he
taste.
hadn't told me that, then I probably wouldn't have noticed. Maybe it tastes a bit more burnt, for want of a. I mean, not really burnt, but so, you know, you notice the difference between. I mean, in vegetable oil is far more neutral
Yeah.
as a medium, whereas you know when you've eaten fish and chips
Lard
fried in
packs a
lard. But
punch, yeah.
yeah, but it, but maybe if you're used to the lard, it would work in reverse, that you'd notice the vegetable oil
Yeah,
instead.
yeah. So this is an interesting idea. I mean, lard is now pretty much reviled as a tool, although, gosh, it tastes delicious. But at what stage did the health of the dish really crop up? Because I must say, I don't eat fish and chips that often because it's often cooked quite badly, I feel just rotten afterwards because of the amount of fat. But is that just the perception that I have? What was there a sort of a turning point where people started going off fish and chips, nutritionally, I mean?
I mean, I think if we go back into its history, it's important, and you know, it's the whole history of British work, actually, you need to take into consideration, because when the majority of the population or a significant minority undertook manual labour, then it was fine to eat fish and chips twice a day, which is what
Yeah.
seems to have happened in some parts of the country, you know, in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, I think the idea of it being unhealthy takes off, especially during the course of the 1980s. But then, I mean, when I'm asked this question, I think what I would always say is it's actually quite a healthy dish if compared with virtually any other takeaway.
Yes,
I mean, if
absolutely.
you have one of these creamy curries, then, well, okay, you do know what's in there. I mean, it's fried fish, ultimately. I mean,
Yeah.
you know, how you view the potatoes is slightly different, but I mean, I can't see, even though it's deep fried, I don't necessarily see how that's unhealthy. You know, maybe it's the deep fat. I mean, you know, there's lots of things you can, you know, if you deep fat fried beef, then that's obviously, or lamb, then that's obviously, you know, dangerously unhealthy. You know, white fish, and if you chose to take off the skin, then that's probably quite a healthy
Yeah. I
dish,
do
I
sometimes
think.
try and convince myself, like, have some fish and chips, just have a few chips. And you know what? You don't need to eat all the batter. And then you break it open, and there is
Yeah,
this most delicious, moist fish
exactly.
inside. And then you smell the batter and you go, I just have a little bit. And then suddenly the whole flipping lot's gone. And you think,
Well,
oh no,
I
that's a
guess
problem.
that's the yeah, that's where the flavor comes from, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we're back to the Maillard reaction and those which takes a high temperature. Anyway, that's me drifting off. So now I mentioned salt and vinegar, tartar sauce in as I introduced this episode. Condiments and sort of sidecars are an important part of the meal. Like, you know, there's curry sauce. God, curry. Not with fish as well for me. But there's ketchup. I have here one of my favourite tools to accompany the fish and chip, a pickled egg, rather small pickled egg here, but I'm a big fan. Why are the accompaniments, I didn't mention mushy peas actually, why are the accompaniments so important, and are they uniquely British, would you say?
The accompaniments take off, but it's the mushy peach which seems to come first, actually.
Oh, okay.
That seems to appear around 1920, and so I guess it's important because, you know, it's the vitamins, which so it's protein, carbohydrate, and that provides the vitamins. But I mean, in the original dish, there doesn't seem to have been any greens, if you like. And so that's when that takes off. And then by the 1950s, 1960s, then you have all sorts of other stuff that's served in fish and chip shop. So I remember from the fish and chip shop I used to always go to as a child with my dad, they always had rotisserie chicken. I mean, that takes off in the post-war period. And stuff like curry sauce, tomato ketchup, I think that's, I mean, curry sauce obviously can't have appeared before the 1970s, and somehow that's a bastardization of curry, I would have thought. And I can't ever remember curry sauce as a child. And I'm also wondering if there's a regional thing with regard to, I mean, I can't remember mushy peas on the menu when I was a child growing up in London, whereas it seems to have been much more widespread. You know, in the north in particular. And then the tomato ketchup, I remember having fish and chips with someone, and he's about 20 years younger than me, and he used ketchup, and I don't think people of my age, I think ketchup took off probably in the 1980s and the 1990s.
Yeah, when I was growing up, it was strictly rationed in my house. You could have a dab of it if you were good. And then I'd see my mum and she'd go all over, but I wasn't dipping it out of it. Much like the margarine, which I had to use, and she basically used the... No, I can't say things like that. It's not the place all the time. Okay, now, as I mentioned, my fish and chips cost me £10.80, although that did include an 80p pickled egg. I would say that's quite an expensive meal now. Certainly you can get a much cheaper burger at an establishment just down the road from where I bought it, not far from Essex Road, to be honest. But it has become different, hasn't it? It's evolved. I would often buy it in a pub where I think, oh, God, all this stuff that they've got in the pub, I don't think they can cook it that well. You know, they've got the menu's too big. It must come straight out of the fridge. But the fish and chips, I get the fact that that's relatively easy to cook and they're not going to screw it up. But overall, it's become a lot posher. I mean, there were restaurants like Harry Ramsden's, which is almost impossible to get into these days, or there was the legendary Magpie Cafe in Whitby. But when did it become a restaurant experience dish? And was it a sort of a surprise to the chippy owners that, hang on, they were serving it for 20 quid in a restaurant?
Again, I that's probably a late 20th century, 1990s probably onwards. I mean, it's probably got something to do with what I was saying earlier about it being a British dish. And so, you know, if you're going to go into a restaurant, which, I mean, there's not that many restaurants which sell themselves as British, but, you know, into a mainstream...
But you'll get them in somewhere like the Woolsey and those sort of posh restaurants will have a 30 quid fish and chips and the Ivy and places like that.
Well, maybe...
You're reluctant about this one, aren't you? You're not sure.
No, I mean, I have... I didn't realise the Ivy did it, but, I mean, I have been in posh restaurants which serve fish and chips. And once I remember I went with my wife to a restaurant in York, and what they did there was just serve about, I don't know, 8 chips, which were really even bigger than the ones you've been describing.
And they were stacked. Jenga pile.
Yeah, they were stacked up. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. So I mean, somehow it's perhaps an embracing of Britishness or the deproletarianization of fish and chips.
Oh, here we go. We've got a historian on the job here, clearly. And so do you think it is seen much less as a working class dish, or is it the fact that society has evolved a little bit and people are happy to spend more money on what we used to see as a very basic, you know, filling dish?
Well, I mean, it is, as you've said a minute ago, I mean, it is more expensive than, well, most other takeaways, actually. I mean, I don't know what is, there isn't, I don't think there is anything that's more expensive, you know, whether it's curry, Chinese food, I mean, burgers, I mean, they can be very cheap because it depends on what meat you're using in the burger. And so it's probably also no longer viewed as working class because it's quite expensive. I mean, when the fish and chip shop was at its height, around 1900. I mean, you can't really say you would have a chip shop on every corner, but I mean, they were just so widespread. Whereas, I mean, nowadays that, they've expanded the range of their products. So the 8,600 you said that existed at the beginning of the program, I wonder how many of them would actually describe themselves primarily as fish and chip shops, because nowadays
you're absolutely right. I mean, the one I bought this from had the massive kebab foot in behind it. There's one at the other end of the road that is a Chinese takeaway plus fish.
Yeah, I mean, that's diversification is a method of survival, both because of the after the 1960s when Chinese and Indian food and Italian food actually at the same time takes off, then it just becomes one takeaway out of many. And so the diversification by the end of the 20th century is one way of survival. But it's also a way of bringing in new products.
I guess so. For me, it makes me think, well, I think you need to be an expert at Chinese food. And if you also do fish and chips, which you also need to be an expert at as well. I mean, I'm sure there are people that can do these things, but it's about having all the tools and the backroom stuff and the kit and the ingredients to be able to do it. So that slightly puts me off, but it shouldn't do, really, should it?
Well, I mean, the other explanation for what we've just been describing is that probably after 1945, after the Second World War, increasing numbers of fish and chip shops are owned by migrants. So in London, it's especially Greek Cypriots. Well, actually, also in the provinces, in provincial large, well, everywhere. And so in Leicestershire, most Greek Cypriots who came to Leicester did so to open up fish and chip shops. And so, the transition to serving kebabs is obviously quite straightforward.
And why is it in immigrant communities that were drawn to this type of industry?
Well, one of the answer I'll give you is there's somebody called Joe Pieri who wrote three different books about his life as a fish and chip shop owner in Glasgow in the early 20th century. And one of his arguments is because it's really hard work, and it's labouring work basically. It's hard. I mean, he doesn't use the word hard labour, but he goes into great detail about what time he has to get up in the morning, what the tasks they have to undertake.
It's tough,
and the hours they work. I mean, so one of the people I interviewed for my project, who owns Grimsby Fisheries, which is a very big fish and chip shop in Leicester, he said that his father brought the business from an English person or a white British person in the 1960s who used to have this long midday break, and when they took it over they opened for quite long hours. And he explained it by saying that his father was a peasant, if you like, in Cyprus, and was so really used to hard work, and so it was just a continuation of that. And the explanation for Chinese plus fish and chips is similar, that in the north, especially, Chinese people have were quite important in the post-war fish and chip trade. And so introducing Chinese was quite straightforward. Yeah. So I think that's, apart from the diversification, that's the other explanation for why you can buy all these things in the same shop.
Yeah. I mean, also, I don't know if this is just a romanticised view, but my perception of immigrants in terms of the immigrants that I know is that these tend to be the people who have lots of energy and adventure, and they've left their country, they've done something quite dramatic, they're prepared to do something quite dramatic for various reasons, either they're escaping somewhere or because it's they want to try something else or for economic reasons, and therefore they've got the energy to do things, whereas the incumbents here don't quite have the energy. They're not the driven ones, because the driven ones in the UK that emigrate and go somewhere else are also the energetic ones. Yeah, that's why immigration is can be so upsetting, because these are the people who've got they've got the energy, they've got the go to actually do these things, and set up things like corner shops, fish and chip shops. These things take huge amounts of energy.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a complex picture. I mean, in the case of the Cypriots. The one of the things about Cypriots is that they own their own land, so they're entrepreneurial, and so they standing on your own two feet is quite important. In the case of the Chinese, a lot of Chinese people actually moved to Britain in connection with the catering trade, That's a natural step to set up on your own. And then the other group, which is very important, is Italians in the early 20th century. And again, they tend to open up ice cream parlors in some cases, and also fish and chip shops. And in a sense, they're sort of outsiders who come into working class communities when this all takes off at the beginning of the 20th century. And you know, with quite a lot of entrepreneurialism, if you like.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned sort of certain points where that, you know, fish and chips were so important. When was the peak of fish and chips, and has that passed now? Is it now in some sort of decline?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the peak of, so if you read some accounts, there's about, so the peak seems to be about 25,000 fish and chip shops. Wow. From about the, you know, 1900 onwards. The decline is certainly in place by the 1960s, for sure. And it was almost like that was the standard takeaway in that period. I mean, you know, there are other takeaways between, you know, let's say 1890 and 1960, but not in the way there was after the arrival of, I mean, it's China, you know, if you read about the excitement when Chinese takeaways arrive, I mean, you know, it's extraordinary. You can read catering papers, or you can read, you know, the Mirror or something like that, and you know, they have these reports about, you know, it's just highly, it's almost an event when the first Indian restaurant or the first Chinese restaurant opens,
like the first McDonald's in Moscow.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, I have a PhD student doing the history of the burger in Britain, and the first McDonald's in Britain was in Woolwich, funnily enough, in 1974, Daniela Lascali and her research exactly deals with this, the excitement, the newspaper reporting when the first McDonald's arrives in a particular location. And so, you know, it's a part of the same process, whether it's Chinese, Indian or McDonald's, there's just far more choice. So the fish and chip shop is inevitably going to decline, and you know, its position of power, if you like, it just declines from that period because of choice.
Also, fish and chips weren't rationed during the Second World War. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, that's because I guess the potatoes are readily available, and you know, the blockade wouldn't have impacted in the same way that it would have in the German case, for instance.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the other historians who's written about the history of fish and chips, I think, claims that Britain won the First World War because of fish and chips. Because, you know,
you've got to base your book on a thing, haven't you?
Yeah. No, I mean, that his argument is about the working class, John Walton, about the working class and for the fish and chips.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't dispute what he says. He may overplay it, but, you know, the fact that you have, I mean, it's going back to this ready, easy supply of nutrition, you know, which by the 1980s, it's become synonymous with unhealthy food, whereas in the early part of the 20th century it was completely the opposite,
where you needed as many calories as you could.
Exactly. If you're a miner or you know, any other type of manual labor.
Now, this is a food industry podcast, although we do let the occasional civilian listen to it if they're very well behaved, but can we relate it to the food industry in the UK at all? When did the food industry start producing frozen fish and chips, and when did that become important?
I think that probably takes off in the 1960s and the 1970s.
And does that fundamentally change the way that we eat, or the economics of the model?
Not really, because that's just a completely different taste, isn't it? I mean, it goes back to taste. I mean, you can't reproduce, you know, what you get straight out of the deep fat fryer
from the chippy. Although people used to have, we used to have the chip pan. You know, there was one pan knackered, but we never made the fish at home. It was only
no,
the chips.
Exactly. Well, then, I mean, we used to. Yeah, my mother always used to, God, almost on a daily basis, I remember, fry chips for us. I mean, they weren't, you know, perfectly shaped. But yeah, but you'd never try
kitchen
the.
Kitchen used to stink, didn't it?
Yeah, you'd never fry the fish, and the stuff you get out of the frozen packets is obviously completely different.
Mm. But the industrialization of freezing and of supplying fish and chips was that part of the death knell for the fish and chip shop?
Well, decline rather than death knell.
Sorry, you're right.
I don't think it is actually. I think it's the choice of other takeaways. Because I mean, if you want the real fish and chip experience, you don't. I mean, that's just a substitute. I mean, it's not the same. There's no way it's the same if you take something out of a frozen fish and put it in an oven. I mean, presumably there's ways in which you can take these things out and deep and fry them in your own home, but I mean that's quite a complex process, and I still don't think. And I guess you need to put it into wider context of the takeoff of the frozen hamburger, the takeoff of, you know, these ready curries and Chinese foods. And again, that's something that happens in the 1960s and 1970s. But so, you know, actually what's happening is that you're having the move of takeaways into the home, which again is what happens in, you know, it's the same with hamburgers. They're pioneered it's Wimpy, which is the pioneer for hamburgers, and then they move into the home. So it's a desire to eat these takeaway products at home, which, you know, lots of people do, and it's you know, just a normal part of British eating. But
And do you think that fish and chips has suffered from the delivery model of Deliveroo and Uber Eats and things like that? Because as we mentioned, it's not great when it's been packed for 20 minutes in a bag. Although I will happily eat my chips if it takes 20 minutes to get home. Do you think it's suffered compared to other available fast foods?
Well, I think the way that fish and chip shops have tried to get around this is that they've developed boxes, haven't they?
Yeah. So this is what I've got here. I was slightly upset. I wanted to get my fish and chips with fish and chips printed on it.
Exactly. Yeah. So that probably means less sogginess, if you like.
Yeah. So there are ways of achieving it.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's never going to be the same as having it straight out of the deep fat fryer.
Absolutely.
Whereas, you know, maybe if you have a Chinese meal or a curry, that delay is not as important.
And you can reheat it much more easily than exactly. Fish and chips doesn't. You know, a reheated chip, it's a fool's game. Okay, so I'd just like to finish off then with a couple of recommendations from you. Are you a cod and chips man? Are you a skate and chips man? A rock and fish man? And do you have a recommendation of a fabulous place to eat fish and chips?
Actually, I do this thing where I go into a fish and chip shop and ask for fish and chips. But I mean, I think so. But I mean, I wouldn't. If I was offered skate, then I'd probably reject that. So what I'm usually offered is either cod or haddock, basically. Yeah. So, you know, one of my the people I interviewed said haddock's better because it's even firmer than cod.
Yeah. And what do you accept sort of Coley and Pollock?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I remember once I in the National Archives and they had a choice between cod and pollock. But I mean, I always went for cod because that's what I knew. I think they're very similar, firm white fishes. Yeah. I think the best fish and chips I've ever had was Rick Stein's in Padstow.
Yeah, you'd hope so, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't necessarily any more expensive than anywhere else, but I mean, I really did enjoy that.
And why was it so good?
Probably because he's so conscious about the importance of crispiness, I think, and he has a special type of batter. I mean, there's all sorts of different type of batters as well that you can use, but I mean, this was a quite light one and light and crispy. I mean, I'm happy with heavy and crispy, but light and crispy seems even better.
Okay, well, that's a fantastic recommendation. Well, Professor Panikos Panayi, Professor of Fish and Chips at De Montfort University, although you do, as we know, do have a sideline in European history. Thank you so, so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. So much information there. Now I've got a pile of soggy chips and half a soggy fillet of cod. I'll send that over to you by bike and you'll get it sometime tomorrow. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember,